Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I've just been updated by the Chief of Staff that the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Lara Jani, and the head of the besieged Iran's Central Repression Apparatus, Soleimani, who is responsible for the massacre of the protesters, was eliminated last night.
As the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran enters its 18th day, Israel claims it's assassinated two of the most powerful figures in Iran, the security chief, Ali Larijani, as well as the head of the besieged military. We'll speak with Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute and Harrison Mann, a former U.S. intelligence officer who resigned from the army over the U.S.-backed Israeli war on Gaza. Then Cuba is facing a nationwide blackout as President Trump again threatens to take over the island.
I do believe I'll be the honor of having the honor of taking Cuba. That'd be a good honor. It's a big honor.
And then to Texas, where eight anti-ICE protesters have convicted on terrorism charges for taking part in a demonstration outside the Prairieland ICE jail in Texas. They each face at least 15 years in prison. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military says it's killed the Iranian security chief, Ali Larijani, as the U.S. and Israel continue massive airstrikes across Iran. Larijani was among the most powerful figures in the Islamic Republic and helped direct nuclear negotiations with the U.S. and other Western powers. His reported assassination comes just days after he joined senior Iranian officials in a march through central Tehran in a public act of defiance against the U.S.-Israeli war. Israel also announced it had assassinated the besieged force commander, Ghulam Reza Soleimani, in a separate airstrike. In the city of Iraq, officials say a U.S.-Israeli coalition bombing killed a three-day-old infant and his two-year-old sister, along with their mother and grandmother. In Tehran, Iranian Red Crescent workers search for survivors through the rubble of damaged homes after an airstrike on Monday.
This alley is totally residential. Those dear residents who got stuck here are being rescued by the aid workers. The search continues.
Amnesty International reports an investigation found the U.S. was responsible for the attack on the Iranian girls' school in southern Iran that killed about 170 people, most of them schoolgirls, on the first day of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Iran's foreign minister says U.S.-Israeli strikes have killed over 200 children. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's announced the deployment of thousands of additional U.S. Marines and warships to the Middle East. U.S. Central Command reports at least 200 U.S. troops have been injured since the U.S. and Israel launched attacks against Iran just over 2 weeks ago. 13 U.S. service members have been killed. In Israel, at least seven people were wounded on Monday when a rocket launched from Lebanon struck residential buildings in the northern town of Nahariya. Elsewhere, debris from an Iranian missile fell onto the rooftop of the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate in Jerusalem, one of the holiest sites in Christianity, where tradition holds that Jesus was crucified. An Iranian missile also damaged the U.S. consulate residence building in Jerusalem, though no injuries were reported. Meanwhile, Iran continues to fire on Middle East countries that host U.S. military bases. Saudi Arabia's defense ministry said it intercepted nearly 100 Iranian drones in 24 hours, the largest single-day wave of attacks yet by Iran. In the United Arab Emirates, An Iranian drone triggered a huge fire at a key oil trading hub, coming just days after a similar attack triggered another fire at the site. In Iraq, an Iranian drone damaged the top floor of the Al-Rashid Hotel in Baghdad's heavily fortified grain zone Monday, amidst reports that Iraqi air defenses shot down an Iranian missile targeting the U.S. embassy there. Meanwhile, Kuwait and Qatar reported more Iranian drone and missile attacks. According to Goldman Sachs, if the war lasts until the end of April, the gross domestic products of Gulf states could plummet by up to 14% this year. In Lebanon, Israeli strikes have driven more than 1 million people from their homes and killed more than 880 people. Israeli troops launched ground operations in southern Lebanon Monday. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, said southern Lebanese residents will not return to their homes until the safety of Israelis near the border is guaranteed. This is a displaced mother who fled to Beirut due to Israeli attacks.
Of course, I was displaced, my house was damaged, the situation is difficult, of course. I mean, I can't describe to you the feeling that we're experiencing, but it's hard, very hard. It's hard to leave your home, hard to leave your land.
European countries are rejecting President Trump's call to send warships to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, despite Trump's threat of, quote, a very bad future, unquote, for NATO if it doesn't help the U.S. This is Kaja Kallas, the European Union's foreign policy chief.
There was no appetite from the member states to do that. As I said, this is nobody wants to go actively in this war. And of course, everybody is concerned what will be the outcome.
Australia and Japan also said they had no plans to send warships to help reopen the strait. South Korea said it's an issue that needs, quote, very careful deliberation, but did not commit to helping the U.S. The New York Times reports President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is trying to raise $5 billion in additional funding for his private equity firm from Gulf Arab states, even as he serves as a top U.S. government negotiator in the Middle East as part of his fundraising effort. Kushner's representatives have already met with Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, which is headed by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and has already funded the private equity firm of Jared Kushner to the tune of $2 billion. In Texas, Lakah Cordia walked free from an ICE jail Monday after more than a year in custody. She was arrested during the 2024 Gaza Solidarity protests at Columbia University. Those charges were dropped, but Cordia was later detained at a routine immigration check-in in New Jersey. This week, an immigration judge ordered her released on a $100,000 bond. It was the third time a judge ruled in her favor, despite the government blocking her release twice. While in custody, Lakah Cordia was hospitalized following a seizure, and her legal team said her legs were chained to her bed and she was denied access to her lawyer or family. Cordia was the last person still held in detention from the Trump administration's crackdown on pro-Palestinian campus activists. A federal judge in Boston's blocked Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s overhaul of U.S. vaccine policy, including blocking a January directive slashing the number of recommended childhood vaccinations from 18 to 11. Under RFK Jr., the CDC had dropped recommendations that all babies should be protected against hepatitis A, hepatitis B, RSV, dengue, and two types of bacterial meningitis. U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy wrote in his ruling, quote, there is a method to how these decisions historically have been made, a method scientific in nature and codified into law through procedural requirements. Unfortunately, the government's disregarded those methods and thereby undermined the integrity of its actions, unquote. Judge Murphy also found Kennedy violated federal law when he fired all 17 members of the Centers for Disease Control's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and replaced them with hand-picked appointees who've questioned established medical research on vaccines. In Cuba, the national electricity grid collapsed Monday, leaving millions without power as Cuba reels from an energy blockade imposed by President Trump. It was the third major blackout in Cuba over the past 4 months and the largest. This comes as the New York Times reports that the Trump administration's pushing for Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel to step down. President Trump spoke to reporters Monday about his plans for Cuba.
I do believe I'll be the honor of having the honor of taking Cuba. That'd be good honor. It's a big honor.
Taking Cuba.
Taking Cuba in some form, yeah. Taking Cuba. I mean, whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it. You want to know the truth?
Later in the broadcast, we'll go to Havana for the latest. In Afghanistan, the Taliban government says 408 people were killed and 250 injured Monday evening after Pakistan, they said, targeted a drug treatment center in Kabul with an airstrike. Pakistan denies the bombing of any health facilities, but reporters who visited the wreckage of the Omar Addiction Treatment Hospital found the 2,000-bed facility on fire and in ruins, with dozens of bodies being carried out on stretchers. The UN reports scores of civilians have been killed since Pakistan's defense minister last month declared open war on Afghanistan. The Trump administration's approved BP's proposed $5 billion oil drilling project in ultra-deep waters off the coast of Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico. BP, formerly known as British Petroleum, is the same company responsible for the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster, the worst oil spill in U.S. history. Environmentalists warn the new project threatens Gulf communities, sensitive deep-sea ecosystems, and imperils marine life. And voters in Illinois head to the polls today for primary elections that could determine the balance of power in the next Congress. Ahead of the election, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, poured nearly $22 million into Illinois' congressional races. Among AIPAC's targets is Kat Abouzela, a progressive running for Illinois' 9th District, covering parts of Chicago and its northern suburbs. She's condemned the war in Gaza as a genocide and has made cutting U.S. military aid to Israel a top campaign priority. She says AIPAC poured $7 million through two shell PACs to defeat her, even as a dark money group was caught paying social media influencers $1,500 each for scripted attack posts. Meanwhile, several candidates are competing for the Senate seat of retiring Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, with a flood of super PAC spending also influencing that race. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
And Juan, I look forward to seeing you next Monday on March 23rd at Democracy Now!'s postponed, but now for sure, 30th anniversary celebration at Riverside Church. We will be live streaming that at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We begin today's show in Iran, as Israel's military says it's assassinated Iran's security chief, Ali Larijani, one of the most powerful figures in the Islamic Republic. Larijani was seen as the de facto leader of Iran following Israel's assassination of the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, on the first day of the war on February 28th. Israel claims it's also assassinated Gholam Reza Soleimani, the head of the besieged military. We begin the show with Trita Parsi, an Iranian-American, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita, if you can explain the significance of this moment. Iran has not confirmed this, but Israel says it has killed the security chief, Ali Larijani. Who is he? And also the head of the Berej militia. Talk about both of them.
Also,
Trita, if you could start again, we just didn't have your audio up.
Oh, I was just saying that
It is confirmed that Larry Johnny's son was killed in this attack, but it's not clear at this point whether Larry Johnny himself was killed. It appears likely, but we don't know yet for certain. And it would be a very significant development, almost on par with the killing of the Supreme Leader. In the past couple of months, he had emerged as a critical person within the Iranian theocracy. He was not so much a decision maker as he was the person who was creating consensus, the consensus maker within that system, but also someone that was seen as much more open to the idea of reaching a diplomatic solution. In fact, there had been some diplomatic outreach between him and a very key person in the White House prior to this war, back in December. So he was definitely seen as someone who the United States potentially at some point could deal with. Whether the Israelis deliberately targeted him because they just had the opportunity, because it was an effort to kill any potential off-ramp for Trump by eliminating those who could engage in diplomacy with him, or whether this is something that has more to do with the fact that perhaps the strategy now is shifting back towards regime decapitation after it's become clear that reopening the straits militarily is going to be extremely difficult. And as a result, the U.S. and Israel are shifting back towards what they started off this war with, was by trying to see if they could decapitate the regime and cause regime implosion. I don't find that very likely. This is definitely a huge tactical blow to the Iranians, but the system already has preparedness for eventualities of this kind. We saw that after the killing of the Supreme Leader, and the same thing will happen with the head of the besieged that has now also been killed.
And Trita, in a recent article you wrote, I'm wondering your sense of where this war is heading. You wrote, one of the main mistakes on the American side is they believe the Iranians feared war more than surrender. In reality, they fear surrender far more than they fear war. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, I think that the United States and the Trump administration went into this war with a very false perception of Iran's state of strength or weakness. They believed that Iran was much, much weaker than it actually was. This was also a narrative that had been dramatically pushed by the Israelis, knowing very well that the arguments for attacking Iran would very much be premised on the idea that it would be a relatively easy and quick thing to do. You need to convince Trump that it's easy and quick in order for him to go along with it. They succeeded in that. See what Marco Rubio said in his testimony in the Senate in January, essentially saying that there is a window of opportunity attacking because of this unique weakness of Iran. The weakest it has been since 1979 was the line. And the perception on the Trump administration side was that either the Iranians would simply be forced to capitulate and surrender, or the regime would implode. And in order to avoid that, they would strike a deal. They would essentially surrender in order to safeguard their own survival. But this is a fundamental misread of the theocracy in Iran, not just because its strength was clearly not as weak as the U.S. thought. On the contrary, we see now very clearly they were very well prepared for this type of a war and have managed to, in some ways, increase their power, particularly their leverage through the Strait of Hormuz, but also because of the fact that at the end of the day, surrender was never in the cards. This is a theocracy that could survive war. It could even survive losing a war. But if it were to surrender, it would lose its base of support. The 15 to 20% of the population that's still supported, they would be completely unforgiving of any such measure. And that would be a far clearer death knell to the theocracy than even a military loss.
Trita, before you go, I know you have to leave within the minute. What do you say to the analysts who are now saying with Lara Johnny, if in fact he is dead, killed by Israel, that Israel recognized him as a negotiator behind the scenes, whether it's with Russia or the United States, and that they don't want these negotiations to take place?
No, from the Israeli standpoint, it's absolutely clear they want this war to continue as long as the U.S. is in the war and actively bombing Iran. They're very fearful of Trump declaring victory and just ending the war. They have still achieved quite a lot because the Iranian military has been significantly degraded in several different aspects. However, the Israelis have fought so hard to get the United States to go into a full-scale war with Iran. For more than 20 years, they have tried to do this. So now when that has finally been achieved, it is in their interest to prolong this war as long as they can and kill off any potential off-ramps that Trump may be looking for. And if Trump actually were to look for an off-ramp actively, a critical counterpart of his would most likely have been Ali Larijani. And we've already seen that several people who could have played that type of a role have been killed. And the remaining people within the theocracy tend to be the much more hardline ones who also see a benefit in prolonging the war rather than negotiating an end to it.
Trita Parsi, we want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Coming up, Harrison Mann, a former U.S. intelligence officer who resigned from the Army over the war in Gaza. His new piece, I was a U.S. intelligence analyst. Here's what a ground invasion of Iran could look like. Back in 30 seconds.
I wanna go all over the world and start living free. I know that there's somebody who is waiting for me. I'll build a boat steady and true as soon as it's done.
Someone performed by Lila Downs in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue our look at the U.S. and Israeli war on Iran, numerous nations have rejected a request from President Trump to send warships to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has largely shut down the critical waterway. About 20% of the world's oil exports flows through the strait. On Monday, Germany's defense minister said, "This is not our war." President Trump criticized allies who are refusing to help.
I don't do a hard sell on them because my attitude is we don't need anybody. We're the strongest nation in the world. We have the strongest military by far in the world. We don't need them. But it's interesting. I'm almost doing it in some cases, not because we need them, but because I want to find out how they react.
Meanwhile, Trump continues to give mixed messages on his war plans. On Friday, he was interviewed by Brian Kilmeade on Fox News.
When are you going to know when it's over?
When I feel it.
Okay.
I feel it in my bones.
When I feel it in my bones. This all comes as the U.S. is sending 2,500 Marines and an amphibious assault ship to the Middle East. We go now to Harrison Mann, former U.S. Army major who resigned in 2024 from the DIA, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency, over the Biden administration's policy in Gaza. He's now a senior fellow at Win Without War, a network of activists and groups working for a more peaceful, progressive U.S. foreign policy. His most recent piece for Zatteo is headlined, "I was a U.S. intelligence analyst. Here's what a ground invasion of Iran could look like." Harrison Mann, welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us what that ground invasion can look like as the U.S. is bringing thousands more U.S. troops to the Gulf region.
Thank you. So for context here, I think really from day two of this war, the Trump administration has not known what to do and how to get out of this. So there's really little left to try other than a ground invasion. The other context I want to add is that from the Israeli side, as your last guest, Trita, mentioned, a long war that aims to collapse the Iranian state is good for them. So with that in mind, there's a couple options that Trump administration officials themselves have floated in the press. One is doing a landing on something called Kharg Island, which handles 90% of Iran's oil exports and is located deep in the Persian Gulf past the Strait of Hormuz. Another option also floated by Trump officials themselves is some kind of raid on Iranian nuclear sites to try and secure or sabotage Iran's highly enriched uranium. To talk about the Marines you mentioned, I think it's really important to note you know, we've seen this Marine Expeditionary Unit described as 5,000 troops, or you said 2,500 Marines. There's 5,000 sailors and Marines aboard these ships altogether. There's only about 1,200 actual ground troops, which is a relatively small number if you're talking about invading a country, even if it's just seizing a small island. So I want us to keep that in mind. I think the target that has seems to have risen to the top of Trump's list, we saw him and Lindsey Graham tweeting about it over the weekend, is Kharg Island. Again, it's a piece of critical oil infrastructure. The idea is that if you can capture it, you will basically get to hold 90% of Iran's oil exports hostage. The issue with this is that you have to sail. If you're going by ship, you have to make it through the Strait of Hormuz, which the U.S. Navy currently determines is too dangerous for it to go through. Or if you fly in, you're still landing on an island that's just about 15 miles off the coast of Iran. So frankly, I think any attempt to seize this island would be close to a suicide mission. I hate to say it, with U.S. troops within range, not just of the drones and missiles that Iran has targeted the whole Gulf and Israel with, but also shorter range weapons that they haven't had the opportunity to use yet. Artillery, rockets, short-range drones. And it's really easy to imagine how if you drop troops on that island, they could really end up being trapped there, which would really play into the hands of the Iranian government. And I think a U.S. mass casualty event or even a de facto hostage situation would be much more valuable to Iran's surviving leaders than the oil terminal that the operation would purportedly capture.
And Harrison, man, what about the logistics nightmare? Even if they were able to land troops, which I'm sure they would be able to, the logistics nightmare of protecting and supplying any force like that so deep into the Persian Gulf and so close to Iran.
Yeah. Again, I think resupply or even insertion or evacuation by sea is extremely dangerous for all the weapons I mentioned. Plus, Iran, as has been discussed in the news, can mine these waters, both around the island and in the Strait of Hormuz. They have drone boats in addition to aerial drones. If you want to try and do resupply or reinforcement by air, that might be possible, but it's possible to ambush aircraft as well. We saw the Houthis do it in the campaigns in the Red Sea over the past 2 years. So even aerial resupply or insertion would be quite fraught. And it's a real risk that you have U.S. troops trapped under fire and running out of supplies on this island. And I want to mention, this really applies to anywhere that you put U.S. troops on Iranian soil. Some figures on Fox News have also discussed trying to land troops near the Strait of Hormuz to clear out anti-ship missiles there to make it safe for oil tankers and shipping to go through. I mean, that really gives you the exact same risk of troops trapped in Iran, where it's extremely difficult to resupply or just get them out of there.
I wanted to ask you also about Israel. Israel is involved now in a multi-front war here, not only with Iran and defending against missiles coming, retaliatory strikes from Iran, but in Lebanon as well. There are still Israeli troops in Syria, and they're fighting two domestic fronts in the occupied territories of the West Bank also and in Gaza. How long can Israel, in your sense, keep up this kind of multi-front war?
I think Israel can honestly keep it up as long as the U.S. continues to supply it with munitions and an incredible amount of air defense and air protection. Right? There's nothing really keeping the Israeli military from pulling out of Iran and focusing entirely on Lebanon. The U.S. is already fighting the war Netanyahu wanted for him, right? Israeli air power is not adding a whole lot to that, so we could see that happen. They could keep going in Lebanon for a while if they continue to enjoy U.S. air defenses, resupply of interceptors, and now the ground munitions, tank and artillery shells that they need to fight in Lebanon. The political side of that, I'm less sure of. I think we're heading towards a nearly unprecedented level of rockets and drones and missiles actually hitting things inside Israel, not being intercepted. So I don't know how long Israeli people will put up with that before demanding political change. But so far, Netanyahu has been pretty successful at keeping public support, or at least preventing substantive opposition to starting new wars, especially over the past 2 years.
What about Harrison Mann? And if you can just say what the DIA does, what you resign from, the Defense Intelligence Agency.